Welcome to Richer Life Insights. Our goal is to help you drive more money, motivation, and meaning into your life. Today I'm having a conversation with Tom Rath about the five elements to living a really great life. So my goals for this conversation are for you to understand what these five elements are, how they're interconnected, and how you can boost your overall level of happiness and fulfillment. Basically what Tom calls well-being. So just a little bit of background on Tom. I think at his core, Tom is really a researcher. He's worked for Gallup for 15 years and leads their workplace research and leadership consulting around the world. So what exactly does this mean? It means he develops and has access to a ton of data. He's written several bestsellers, selling more than 2 million books. And I know him best from his strength-based approach. So his latest book, the one that we're going to be talking about, is called Well-Being, The Five Essential Elements. So Tom, thank you so much for being on here.
Thanks so much. It's great to talk to you.
So I'm sure everyone's dying to know, can you just briefly list what these five elements are, and then we'll go into a little bit more detail?
Sure. Yeah, we just for a little bit of background around the basis, we studied people in over 150 countries, everything from going door to door to calling people on the telephone like you're used to Gallup doing here in the States. And we uncovered five common elements that held up across all those countries and cultures. And those are what we labeled as career well-being, which is basically what you do, whether you're a teacher, a stay-at-home dad or mom or retiree, that's career well-being. And second element, social well-being, are your relationships. The third is financial well-being. The fourth is physical well-being, which is more focused on your physiological health. And the fifth one is community well-being, which has a lot to do with how much you're giving back on a regular basis.
Now, so let's talk about what well-being is, because it means more than just being happy, right? How did you define what well-being is?
You know, it's interesting. The way we set out with our research teams and a big panel of senior scientists who are physicians and economists, psychologists, and so forth, we set out to say, what are all the things we need to measure if our goal is to study human beings in every walk of life all over the planet? And so we knew we needed to ask about how secure they felt. We knew we needed to ask about their jobs, about their faith, about their social relationships, all these different elements. And then we stepped back after we asked hundreds and hundreds of questions and said, what word is kind of the broadest description of the way people experience and evaluate their lives? And that's where we use the word well-being. So it's certainly much more than happiness. It's both about how you experience your life each day, how you'd rate things overall, and a lot of it, I mean, the happiest people we interview, it's to a large degree about how much they're giving back and contributing and their meaning and purpose.
No, especially when we get into the financial well-being component, you do talk a lot about how you certainly feel a lot better when you give than when you receive, and so I can understand how that could be the case here. And so I just want to also point out that even though you just said it, you weren't in the shower and you came up with these five things saying, well, this is probably what makes someone, you know, have a higher degree of well-being. This is really, really focused on talking to hundreds, probably thousands of people and really identifying what these five elements are, right?
Yeah, we interviewed actually millions of people in more than 150 countries, and we had people on the ground doing interviews in Iraq and Afghanistan and Zimbabwe. And in the United States, we, in partnership with Healthways, interview 1,000 people every single night just to see how well-being's doing on a national level every day of the week. So we've got more data than we sometimes know what to do with, and we step back and used a statistical technique called factor analysis. So we're actually letting the numbers guide us to say what are the ways that these big areas of life cluster, and that's how we arrived at those five big categories that we knew were important for people in any different part of the world. So I mean, there are some elements that vary from one place to another, and we kind of let those fall by the wayside and said, what are there a few that everybody needs to have a basic level of well-being in each of those five areas, basically. And what we found is that while 66% of people are thriving or doing pretty well in one of those five areas, only 7% are doing well in all five. So most of us have a lot of room for improvement.
Well, so that brings up an interesting question, because clearly one of your areas of focus is focusing on your strengths, identifying your strength and really focusing on it. And you wrote in the book that if you have an intense focus in just one of these five areas of well-being, that it really can impact sort of your overall well-being. And I'm just wondering, shouldn't we sort of focus on our strength in one of these areas? What would be wrong with doing that?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting because we've done so much work over the years from a personality standpoint of helping people to understand why they need to focus on their strengths instead of trying to be well-rounded and a little bit good at everything. And the point is to try and be great at one or two things, right?
Right, exactly.
Then as we got into the study of well-being, we started to see that it may be a little bit different in terms of what's most important, where the people who are really thriving overall and saying, my life couldn't be any better and I expect it to be better in 10 years, when we looked at things like that, they were people who are doing pretty well in a lot of different areas. So instead of, we've all seen examples, I guess, of people who have something that's going wrong in a marriage or their social relationships and focus almost all their time on exercise and athletic pursuits and marathons, triathlons, you name it. And that's clearly at the expense of other things that are going on in their lives. And we see the textbook example of people who burn themselves out at work by working 80 hours a week at the expense of what's going on with their families and maybe their physical health. So it does appear to be a little bit more important to look at a balance across these elements. And one of the things that was interesting to me, it was kind of telling, is once we finished all this research and built an assessment to help any of us as individuals kind of see where we are today called Wellbeing Finder, we asked people after they'd taken that to say, well, if you were distributing points, 100 points across those five areas, how many points would you put in each of those buckets? And what was fascinating is the people who put the most weight and value on their financial well-being and thought that finances might be most important, they actually had the lowest levels of well-being overall when we looked at their scores. And the people who thought that community well-being was most important, which is kind of about giving back, they had the highest levels of overall well-being. So you could see in that little experiment how focusing too much energy on the importance of your finances or how much money you make could be detrimental to your overall well-being as well.
Yeah, I mean, and there's been a lot of research, and you even mentioned some of it in the book, that we really are pretty bad at predicting what's going to make us happy in the long term. And why do you think that is? Why do you think we're just so bad at being able to figure out what it is that's going to make us happy? Because we put a lot of emphasis, like you said, on making money and our health, yet at the end of the day, those two things aren't necessarily the ones that make this sort of richer life, is what I call it.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting to me is that when we look at if there's any relative order of importance out of those five, we don't say that one's necessarily more important than the other, but when we look at what has the strongest statistical relationship to overall evaluation of your life, the first one is your career well-being, or kind of your mission, purpose, meaning, what you're doing when you wake up each day. The second one is your social well-being, your relationships, physical and financial, or financial and physical in that order, are actually third and fourth if you try and force them into an order of importance. And my hunch, personally, this is more of an observation, is just that, you know, our financial health or our wealth, let's just say, is relatively easy to measure. So you know how much money you make either an hour, in a year, and a lot of people know their net worth overall. And that's kind of easy to compare and see how that is versus your neighbor or your colleague, whatever it might be. We know those statistics around our physical health. We know how much we weigh. We know how much we eat on a day-to-day basis. We look at calories. But we really don't have very good measures about how our careers are doing in a comprehensive way that we can track and follow. And we don't have any measures in most cases around the health of our social relationships or what we're giving back to communities. So, one of the things that we've really learned over the years in working with people and organizations around their strengths and engagement is that what gets measured gets managed. And so we know how to measure our BMI, and so we manage towards it. We know how to measure our wealth, so we spend a lot of time spinning our wheels to increase that number of hourly earnings or whatever it might be. But that might lead us to take a little bit of focus off the time we spend with our families and what we're putting into our broader career pursuits and path and so forth.
And you think because some of these are so easy to measure, we shine a light on them and therefore we give more energy to those?
I think that's a part of it. I mean, there are certainly other things that contribute to focusing more energy narrowly in those areas. But, you know, it's interesting. One of the real surprising findings from our nightly tracking of in the U.S. in particular, we ask people how much time they spend with friends or family members, just social time in a given day. And the people who were the happiest, if you have no social time in a day, you have about as many bad moments as good ones, so it's kind of a stressful day. But each additional hour of social time kind of doubles your chances of having more happy moments and fewer stressful moments, all the way out to about 5 or 6 hours where people are doing real good, whether it's time they spend socializing at work, talking to friends on the telephone, instant messaging, emailing, time at home with family. They get about 5 or 6 hours of social time a day. That was a lot more than any of us had ever expected, especially our introverted research team. And and we kind of stepped back and looked at it, and sure enough, I mean, every additional hour of social time could be just as important or more important as every additional hour of sleep, and you don't think about it in that respect.
No, and then that was actually one of the surprising things as well, is when we get into the social element here, is the 6 hours, because I look through my day, and I suppose if you include emails and business phone calls and things like that, probably get 6 hours. And when we get there, I guess I'll just ask you now, does it matter if you're introverted or extroverted, whether you need those 6 hours?
Yes, I was just going to say, you know, the good thing is both you and I are getting an hour right now, so that should help us to get ahead
of the day. You know, I'm already feeling better. Thank you.
There you go. You know, it's interesting because we had StrengthsFinder information based on that StrengthsFinder assessment that we've used on all the people who are going through these studies. We were able to look at that, and the thing that was even more surprising to me is that even people like myself who are more analytical, a little more introverted, really do need about 5 hours a day to kind of have a great day instead of an average one or a mediocre one. People who are extremely extroverted and have a personality theme we call woo, or winning others over at the top of their sequence, they actually need about 6.5 to 7 hours to have a great day. So it varies a little bit in there, but most people could probably benefit from an extra half hour, an extra hour of socializing, whether that's at the water cooler in the office or spending a little bit more time that's focused with family at home.
You know, and honestly, so at my office here, I'm so much about getting things done and being productive and coming in and just working that, you know, I'm not going to admit it to them, but sometimes, you know, if there's discussion going on, I just walk around it and I'm not real into like, well, let's just talk about what happened last night at the game and this. That's not me at all. And maybe I'm kind of doing myself a disservice if what you're saying is we really need to be a little bit more social. We need that one-on-one, even though it's at the expense, in quotes, of using my time. It really could be more of an investment.
Yeah, that was an aha for me, because I'm kind of in the same mode where I'm always got a lot of projects firing and get in real early and try and get as much work done as possible. And I was greatly undervaluing and not paying enough attention to just adding a little social time at work. But it started to challenge my thinking when I read an article. It was an experiment some academics conducted in Germany, I believe. And they were basically monitoring workers throughout the day and had little devices on them so they could tell where they were in the office, who they were talking to, and they actually listened to the content of the conversations as well. And what was even more interesting to me was that even if those conversations in passing were not work-related, so they weren't about a project or anything relevant to what you do for a job, this was in a big consulting company, those social conversations actually increased the productivity levels of both parties, even when they controlled for other variables as well. So it essentially, I mean, even if you're thinking about what's best for your business, the right answer is probably to spend more time just socializing at work, because at a real practical level, if you have developed a relationship with someone or you have a friendship at work and you do need to get something done 3 months down the road, you can probably have a conversation and in 15 seconds get something across that might take 15 minutes with a stranger. So I learned a lot about just the speed created by good relationships. So that's forced me to reevaluate the way I spend my time at work personally too, and try and even though it's uncomfortable for me, to be real honest, force myself into more and more conversations.
Tom, I think you and I are a lot alike because I read that study too, obviously in your book, and I thought, does that mean that I have to dedicate a little bit more? I guess it does. So career, you start, the first essential element is the career, and arguably it's one of the more important ones if you had to put more weight on one over the other, probably only because, you know, we spend so much time at our jobs. And so this one probably wasn't such a surprise for you, but maybe you can talk about why it is just so important to our overall well-being.
Yeah, it was a surprise to me that it was at the top of that list when I looked at the things that carried the most weight, because I would have assumed, as I've been kind of studied psychology most of my life, formally and informally, and I would have assumed that social relationships would have come to the top by a long shot. Just based on all the literature I've looked at on the importance of each of the relationships in our lives. But when we ask people all these questions around the world, the most basic one and maybe the best question we asked in all these countries was, we asked people to rate the statement, "I like what I do each day," either on a 1-to-5 scale or with a yes-no. And that's, if you really have, I guess the litmus test here is, if you have something to look forward to when you roll out of bed in the morning, whether you're a retiree who gets to spend some time with your grandchildren or go to a community center, or whether you're looking forward to going to work at 9 o'clock in the morning, or if you're a student looking forward to going to class, that's what really makes a difference, because it is so important. If we're spending more time at work, as you mentioned, compared to doing anything else, do we at least get to have some moments of enjoyment? It seems like such a low bar to set, but one of the good questions we've asked in our strengths research is, do you get to do what you do best every day? And it's not that none of us get to spend all of our time doing things that we love during the day. I spent some time this morning filling out timesheets and expense reports, and that's not what I do best. But as long as there's some moment in the day where I know I'm going to have the opportunity to do something that fits my strengths real well, that's what seems to make a difference there.
Was there any sort of discovery as far as how much time you need to be spending doing that one thing that you really find is sort of your best work?
Yeah, you know, we've monitored that in more kind of time use studies and have people look at the percentage of time they're spending doing different things. And it's, I think what the best way I've heard someone talk about before is that you really have meaningful time where you know you're using your strengths enough to make a contribution productively for the organization. So it obviously can't just be a brief moment in time, but you need to be able to spend a few hours doing something creative if that's what you thrive on, or spend a few hours talking to people you manage if your real passion and job is to develop other people each day.
One of the things that I talk and write a lot about is what I call the other 8 hours. So the idea is that we sleep 8 hours, we work, quote-unquote, 8 hours, and then we have these other 8 hours. Obviously, it doesn't work that way for everybody, but the point is we have some amount of time that is our own. And, you know, you've probably seen the job satisfaction surveys that, you know, 55% of Americans are just not satisfied with their jobs. They don't like them. One of my advice there is certainly try to find a career that you like. Try to find a job that you like. If you can't, or if you're going through that process, do something in your off time that really hones in on your strengths. Do you think if someone did that, if they had a job that, again, they just don't like, it's not fulfilling to them, it's not passionate, they're not doing anything that really taps into what makes them tick, could they still benefit from this career boost by doing something in their other 8 hours that really taps into what they're good at?
You know, that's an excellent point that I think I kind of forgot to touch on, which we differentiated career well-being, which is more about do you as an individual have the opportunity to do something that you've got passion about each day, which is actually quite a bit different from all the Gallup surveyed 20 million people around the world on the topic of employee engagement. And only 30% of the people we study in the U.S., for example, are really engaged in their jobs by our measures. And you could be in the 70% that's not engaged in your job, you could be in that camp, but still have high career well-being if you have an outside passion that you get to spend some time on each day, and you dedicate time towards those community efforts. There's someone that a personal friend of mine who is clearly not engaged because of having a bad manager and not the perfect work environment, but still spends several hours a week volunteering with a community group that means a lot to her and derives plenty of passion from that. So you can have pretty high career well-being working around that. All that being said, the one other thing I'd mention on career well-being is that if you are either disengaged in your job or looking around for jobs right now, as a lot of people are, one of the things I'd recommend is to spend a lot of time getting to know the person who will be your manager and concentrating more on that relationship with the person who's responsible for your growth and development in a given job, instead of falling into the trap that a lot of job seekers and applicants do and asking all kinds of questions around the benefits plan and perks and things like that. Because one of the biggest discoveries from all of our engagement research over the years is that, you know, people leave managers and not companies. So there's a lot to be said for exploring what your relationship with your supervisor to be will look like, so you can make a good decision about whether you make a career change or take a job.
No, that's interesting. I just had a conversation last night with my sister, who is thinking about moving to another job. And, you know, I have to admit, most of the conversation was about the job itself, the responsibilities, what she'd be doing, and that sort of thing. And, you know, very little was about exactly who are you working for. And so I might have to call her up again after this conversation. And because I can understand, I mean, who you work for, you're not really working for a company. I mean, you really work for your boss or your manager, your supervisor. That's where most of your engagement's going to be.
And even in the best of companies we study with great leaders at the very top, people are leaving bad local teams and bad managers in particular.
Yeah, yeah. And this is probably beyond the scope of this, and you may not even have any awareness of what they call spillover. You know, we were talking before about if you're passionate about something in your off time, how that could actually increase a job that you're not really passionate about. And so there's been a lot of research on this positive work-to-life spillover, but also life-to-work spillover. It's sort of a new area of research, and that probably is one of the reasons why you can have a job that you don't like, but if you're doing something in the hours that you do, it just increases your overall sense of well-being enough to even boost your day job well-being.
Yeah, and it's an important area of research if for no other reason than employers, especially in the United States, need to get their heads around the fact that they clearly have a stake and a vested interest in the well-being of their employees even when they're not clocked in, because that is has such a great influence on not only how productive they are during the day, but how much the organization is liable for, frankly, from a healthcare standpoint and what's going on with their relationships and health at home. That's all coming together in a way that could be pretty positive, because I think there's among the executives I speak to now, there's pretty broad acknowledgement that the work-life balance thing is not about time, where people essentially shut off when they go home or they turn off what's going on at home when they show up at work. Most people acknowledge that that's not a reality.
It's not, and the fact that 70% of employees are, I guess, disengaged, it means that they're just not getting something from their work job. And there's been hundreds of millions of dollars and research on how can we make a better employee during the work hours. And so a lot of research, a lot has been done there, yet very little has been done after people clock out. Like during that free time, I think that is really untapped potential for an employer to say, listen, employee, we're viewing you more than just an employee. You are a person. And if we can help you do some things in your off hours to take some stress away and to help you, you know, sort of live your passion in these other hours, it's going to come back to us. And it's going to come back to us in a big way. I mean, at least that's what the research has shown so far. And so that's a really cool area.
You know, I'll tell you, the most progressive employers on the very edge are getting ahead of that and even investing in the well-being of the family members that surround that employee at home. And they're starting to do a great job of it, or a lot of the Department of Defense groups, Armed Services, because they understand as well as anyone that the well-being of a soldier's spouse and children and family has a direct influence on their performance and what's going on in the job. And it's also fun to see real progressive private employers beginning to realize that now, and hopefully we'll see more and more of that in the future.
Absolutely. I spoke with the head of HR at SAS, which is the largest technology company, private technology company, in America, and they are doing some really groundbreaking things, including the family members. It's not just the employee. They're including their family members. They're holding, you know, employee groups. They're bringing people back into the office, not to work, but to do, you know, financial matters, trainings, programs, really, really cutting edge kinds of things. And their turnover is so much lower than the average for technology companies, and they're saving. And that's the thing I don't think a lot of companies get, is that when you invest a dollar into one of these kinds of programs, you're going to get $2 or $3 or $4 or $5 or $6 back, and especially on the healthcare side. Very, very cool stuff. So what would you say to someone who maybe takes the assessment and realizes, or without even taking the assessment, knows that I just don't like my job? You know, what should they do at that point?
Well, I think the first thing to start thinking about, to one of your earlier comments, was to find some area where you can derive passion each day, even if that's not a part of what you technically get a paycheck to do, because that's a good way to make sure that you're in control of your basic career well-being and using your strengths a little bit, even if your job's not going great or you're in an interim place where you need to find another job and looking around. So that's one kind of overarching strategy. If you think there's hope to fix your job, one thing that I always recommend to people is just to have a real direct conversation with your supervisor, manager at work, because, you know, one of the studies we conducted several years ago that continues to surprise me the most is we asked people in the workplace if their manager was primarily focusing on their strengths or primarily focusing on their weaknesses. And we thought that focusing on their strengths would help more, obviously. But what was most interesting was we coded a third category of people who they said, you know what, my manager's not focusing on my strengths or weaknesses. And so you can almost assume they're being ignored, right? And among people who were in that ignored group, 4 in 10 were actively disengaged in their jobs. Now, that means they're not just not engaged. They're trying to sabotage their workplace. They're telling their colleagues how much they hate their job. They're telling
These are not the employees that you want.
Right. It's a dangerous camp, and none of us want to be in that one. So 4 in 10 were actively disengaged, which is the highest group we've ever seen, if their manager's basically ignoring them. Things actually got a lot better if their manager was focusing on their weaknesses, and only 2 in 10 were actively disengaged.
That is surprising. I mean, it's almost like bad press is good press, right? Like, attention is good.
Yeah, right. So if your manager's completely ignoring you, got to call that to their attention too. But then what really changed my opinion on people's ability to be engaged was when we looked at the people who said, hey, my manager primarily focuses on my strengths, not all the time, but just primarily. Their odds of being actively disengaged or real negative about their job were only 1 in 100. So I might have guessed that there were some people who were just going to be real disengaged in jobs no matter what, but it looks like if there's a good relationship, the manager's paying attention to what you do well, it sure decreases the odds of being in a real bad place in your job. And, you know, I've talked to a lot of real good managers, some with a great deal of talent who just do it naturally, others who have to work at it quite a bit. And there are some managers who need a little bit more push to work on it and maybe just need a little tip from one of the people who works on their team to say, hey, we just need to talk a little bit more and have some conversations and review what's going on, and that can make a difference. That being said, if you've tried everything, you've exhausted every option, you think there's no hope there with the manager, it's probably smart to start looking around for a place where you have the opportunity to do what you do best, to have a good manager, even if it's at a reduced rate of pay. It's been interesting when you look at the amount of money people actually need to have relatively high levels of well-being. Once you get past a level of having some of your basic needs met, so in the U.S., let's say that it's a household income in an average city of $60,000 to $70,000. After that point, even if you double your income, triple your income, the daily experience you have in terms of how much happiness you have on a day-to-day basis doesn't move that much. So it's probably more important to think about your career well-being, your social health, before you worry about whether you might take a 10% pay cut.
You know, that is really great advice. And so the second element is the social side. And there were some surprising things that came out of that when I was reading the book. Talk a little bit about that. It's your overall network, and it's how your overall network really can influence your social well-being.
Yeah, there's been some great research emerging in the last couple of years. A lot of it from a couple of researchers at Harvard, Fowler and Christakis, who they published a book called Connected. If you're interested in the topic, it's a great read. And what they've been looking at from the Framingham, it was actually originally a heart study, started to look at the connectedness of people in the social relationships, and they were finding that you're greatly influenced by the well-being and health and habits like smoking and so forth of the social network that surrounds you all the way out to 3 degrees. So someone who's 1 degree removed from me, a direct connection, influences my well-being maybe 15%. Then 2 degrees out, that's a person I don't know, still has a 10% influence on my well-being because they're a friend of a friend. And you can trace the influence where it's measurable, and I think it's 3 to 5%, all the way out to the third degree. So a friend of a friend of a friend that I don't know at all still has an impact on my well-being. So it's important to think about, are there people in your network who are boosting your well-being overall or dragging it down a little bit? And on average, a new connection boosts your well-being by a little bit. So the more people you have in your network, the higher your overall well-being. So there's usually, if you add a new person, there's a better chance they'll help than hinder that. But an interesting takeaway for me in that was that people who are kind of a mutual connection, so let's say that my wife and I are both friends with the same person, because we share that mutual friendship, that person has disproportionate impact on my well-being because of the impact through my wife as well, because they could either bring down or boost up the well-being of that little network.
So it's a sort of a multiplier effect if you have two or more people that
exactly.
Know the same person. Now, so
right.
Does the size of your network matter?
It does. You know, it's interesting. I wrote a book called Vital Friends 3 or 4 years ago that looked at the social network and friendships in particular. And what I learned from that research that we conducted was that for people who are a little bit more introverted, even you need at least 3 or 4 close social connections to be doing pretty well. So say 3 or 4 very close friends, roughly. And then for people who are quite a bit more extroverted, you might need 7 to 10 in that social network. But by no means do you need a network of 20, from what I've been able to discern, in order to have real high social well-being and to be doing pretty well. Of course, I should say the biggest break is just between 0 and 1. If people can't say that there's a single person they'd reach out to in a time of need when we ask that question, that's one of the most powerful measures of real loneliness, distress, depression, and the like.
So just having the one, you get the biggest boost.
Right.
Now
yeah,
you mentioned
the biggest
just
boost, then there's a bump at 3 to 4, and then it kind of plateaus at 3 to 4 unless you're real extroverted. That's a good way to summarize it.
Okay. And so you mentioned that when you add someone to your network, you get a little bit of a boost. Has there been any research done on Facebook and connecting with old people? Would that be considered part of your network, your social network,
no.
Adding some people like that?
We're starting to do some research on that, and I haven't seen anything that's very definitive yet, but what we were looking at in our workplace research and in our well-being research were much more close connections. So who's someone that you'd call if a tragic event occurred right now? We ask questions like that.
Okay.
And that probably doesn't get at the more distant connections of someone that you might just interact with online now and then.
And so what if you look at your network, 3 or 4, 5, 6, 7 people, whatever it may be, and you find that it's a bunch of Debbie Downers, right? When you've created these friends, you weren't really looking at the research. They just happen to be, you know, coworkers, neighbors, and now all of a sudden, it's just not a real supportive group. What do you do at that point?
You know, we talk about some of the interesting learnings and how it changes our own behaviors through this, but that was one of the interesting things for me as we looked at this, the early research coming out of the networks and some of Gallup's own studies, that if there's someone that's in that close network there who's just consistently a drain on the well-being of not only yourself but other people who are in that overall network there, it's not just a temporary thing and there's no way to repair it in an easy way, it is something that you should very consciously think about how much time you plan on spending around that person, because it's not good for you in terms of your well-being or your physical health even, and it's not good for your spouse, your kids, your close friends as well if that person continues to have a detrimental effect on you day in and day out. If a friend is going through a tough time, we all want to be there and be a supportive friend, and that's what a reciprocal relationship is. But if it's just a continual relationship where there's not that positive give and take, then it's probably a good time to reevaluate if you'd be better off if you spend time with other people, to put it nicely.
It's a nice euphemism to say reevaluate. You mean basically cut them off. No, because
right.
you don't have to say it, Tom. You're too nice to say it. But when I've given speeches about this, I say there are two types of people. There are those that when you're around them, they give you energy, they boost you up, they're optimistic, you know that they've got your back. And then there's everybody else. When you're around them, they take your energy, they're pessimistic, they're always telling you what you can't do and shouldn't do. And my feeling is life is short and you might as well create the network. Rather than just let people come into your sort of inner circle, really be very conscious and selective about who you bring in. It might sound a little callous, but at the end of the day, you really need to be around people that are lifting you up to a big degree.
Yeah, that's very well put.
And so, so the social side, really you need at least one for really close confidant, and if not three or four. And if you have some negative people, you know, try to limit the time as nicely as possible. And maybe just bring in some new people, some fresh blood, possibly.
Right.
So then financial. So this one is sort of near and dear to my heart. I've written a lot about increasing wealth and things like that. And there was some very interesting research in your book about what will and what will not increase your well-being. So maybe you can talk a bit about sort of the financial element.
Yeah, the relationship between money and happiness has obviously been debated and discussed for centuries, and there's actually been quite a bit of conflicting research in the last 20 years with some academics and scientists arguing that, oh, as nations get wealthier, they don't get happier, and there's an economist, Angus Deaton, who's a senior scientist of ours, that's shown that the correlation between the GDP or gross domestic product per capita of a country and its overall well-being, the correlation's a 0.82, so it couldn't be any stronger. So wealthier countries have happier people. That's the latest research from a lot of Gallup's world polling. All that being said, we're also learning that much of that is about having your basic needs met. So once you get to that point where you're not stressed out by debt and you're not worried about whether you're going to make your house payment and you're not worried about whether you have enough money to put food on the table. Interestingly, most people in the U.S. still have to worry about health care costs, so that one doesn't slow down as fast. But after that level, it's more about how you spend your money from what we've been able to determine. So if you save enough money to minimize the stress of debt, that's a real important factor. So it's more about having confidence in your finances and knowing how to manage it. And then if you are going to spend money, I think we started to talk about this earlier, but if I'm feeling down right now and I decide I'm going to go out and buy a new suit to make myself feel better, one, I'll be less discerning in terms of how much I spend on it, so I'll probably spend more than I should have if I was in a normal mood. And two, the novelty of buying that new suit will wear off either tomorrow or after the first time I wear it, and not have any impact on my well-being 3 to 6 months down the road. So what we learned from people who had real high financial well-being is that they were smart about spending their money either on other people. So if I go out and buy a gift for my daughter, that actually is good for my well-being and the well-being of my family. If you give money to charity, donating money or time helps well-being quite a bit. And then maybe most interestingly, that what I've spent a lot more time thinking about myself is how can you, when you're going to spend money, how can you spend on experiences instead of goods that make an impact in terms of the well-being of your social network and the people that surround you? So whether that's a grandparent taking a grandchild out to a movie or museum, whether it's a couple going out and getting drinks and dinner with a friend and spending on that, or whether it's planning a big family vacation. I've been working on that consciously since reading more of this research to say, how can you plan events way out in advance so your whole family gets the benefit of looking forward to it ahead of time, and then you have the actual event itself, which you get a little bit of utility out, not as much as looking forward to it and looking back on it and the reflective piece. So experiences can be a real powerful way to use money.
Yeah, I love the whole thing about looking forward to something because, you know, you're right. It's the anticipation. It's the excitement. It's, you know, when you wake up at 6 a.m. and it's still dark out and it's raining, you think, well, you know what, that's okay because 2 months from now I'm going to be laying on that beach. You really get a lot of bang for the buck before you even go. And so I have done read a lot of research into that. If you're feeling down, if you're feeling a little depressed, schedule something out, maybe with a friend, a month away, a year away, a trip somewhere, and that just that single act can boost your overall sense of happiness. And so that's really cool. And the other thing I really liked about the financial piece is what you call these financial defaults, setting up these financial defaults to make things a little bit easier, to sort of take the thinking out of it. Can you just talk a little bit about what a financial default is?
Sure. That was another interesting piece. We went back and interviewed the people in the U.S. in particular who had the very highest levels of financial well-being, so they were a 10 out of 10 on our measures, and we went back and conducted two-hour open-ended interviews with them and said, what are you doing differently? And what we learned is that the people with the highest levels of financial well-being, in most of the cases, they weren't rich by any conventional standards. So a woman that we interviewed who'd been a school teacher for many years and was nearing retirement, she'd been real careful about setting the default where she gets two paychecks a week like a lot of us do, two paychecks a month. One of those goes to savings. She doesn't touch it at all. She actually has co-signing on her account, so her brother has to sign if she ever wants to access that. And that's, instead of being tactical, it's really more psychological, just so she knows she'll never tap into that reserve, right? And then the other paycheck she gets, the second one, is what she spends on her mortgage and food and gifts and the things that she's doing on a day-to-day basis. And that simple default system made things very comfortable for her going out into the future. And there are other people who companies have gotten smart about helping people to automatically opt in instead of opting out of 401k plans, so that they're encouraging people to set a little bit of money aside before they even have the opportunity to see that cash and spend it. So there are little tricks and things that people can do there from standpoint of saving that help you to be a lot more comfortable. And, you know, if I were to greatly oversimplify some of our learning about money in particular within financial well-being, it is that one of the most important purposes of money is simply to minimize stress that can get in the way of having good days.
It all comes down to the security of what money can provide, not necessarily what it can buy.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I work with sudden money recipients. I do wealth management and sort of financial planning. And so these are people who really, like, pretty normal financially, and then all of a sudden the next day they're in the stratosphere as far as wealth. And just my own anecdotal evidence completely supports what you're talking about. It does not increase people's overall well-being. Maybe momentarily, maybe for a few months, but after that, the sort of the happiness, well-being comes back down to where it was. And even in some cases, you talked about stress. Money can be a source of stress if you don't have it, or if you have a lot of it, now you have to manage it. And
right. And
so that I've always found that to be very, very interesting. In fact, one of my favorite quotes is from Bill Cosby. He said, you know, growing up, we never had any money problems. We never had any money to have a problem. And it's just like,
That's great.
I mean, I get that. And so So to increase your well-being in the financial zone, set up these defaults is what you're saying. Use money to basically buy experiences rather than things. And if you're going to buy something, you're going to feel better if you buy it for someone else than for yourself. Would those be sort of the takeaways?
Yeah, those are the key takeaways.
Okay. So the fourth element to the sort of the, a richer life or a well-being is physical. And I think a lot of people just assume that as you get older, that your physical well-being, that your physical energy necessarily has to decrease. But your research doesn't really suggest that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's obviously just, I mean, aging takes a toll on the body to a degree, but at a minimum, we've seen, and I've read in a lot of research, that people can greatly delay the adverse effects of aging. And several of the people we interviewed with high physical well-being were in their 80s and 90s, and interestingly enough, a lot of them had spent their time working in jobs that required using their hands and being up and around and being more physically active, and they continued to do things and be very active well into their retirement. One guy we talked to was still fixing cars and repairing things for his kids and grandkids and great-grandkids when we spoke. So that when I look at the key elements of physical well-being, they may sound obvious. They're diet, exercise, and sleep. But we learned some novel strategies within each of those three areas from people as we conducted a lot of those interviews.
Yeah, so the three areas are then diet, exercise, sleep. And so what's important to know in each of these?
Well, starting with diet, we talked about the defaults with financial, and defaults might be even more important when it comes to diet. So when I talk about positive defaults, literally if you think about it like I do from a measurement or researcher standpoint, every time we take a bite or have a drink of something, we're either putting something in our mouth that's a net positive, meaning overall it has some good and bad, but it'll be better for us than it is bad in terms of effect on our long-term health, or we can eat something that's a negative. So I might go out and be tempted to get a cheeseburger and french fries and a milkshake at lunch, but I know from a lot of the work that we've done that if I do that now, even the near-term consequences will be that I'll be sleepy in the afternoon, I'll get less done, I'll have less energy to play with my two little kids when I get home tomorrow night if I have the cheeseburger and french fries. So I set myself up with that knowledge to make a better decision, have a lighter lunch or a salad and some vegetables because I know it'll give me more energy and result in feeling better throughout the day. So you kind of set those defaults for yourself there. And then the other thing we learned from people with high physical well-being is they're smart about trying to get ahead of those short-term motivations. So when they go to the grocery store, they only fill their cupboard at home with things that they know they'll be okay eating because you essentially make that decision when you're in the grocery store aisle. If the Cocoa Puffs or the Fruit Loops or the sugary candies come home, they will be consumed because they're more tempting than other things, right?
That's what I tell my wife all the time. It's so much easier to make that decision at the store than it is at 11 o'clock at night.
Right. So, I mean, a part of it's making sure that, I mean, I've read some good books on this where you got to be smart about, I mean, putting fresh cut vegetables even at eye level in your refrigerator so it's the first thing you see. And, I mean, it's all trying to set these defaults so you get ahead of your own bad intuition to grab for the sweetest fried thing in your that you can go after.
Right, we have to be like the grocery store owners, and everything is put in their place for a particular reason. We just have to reverse things, right?
Right, exactly.
So diet extremely important. Exercise. What did you find? Anything that surprised you on the exercise side?
Yeah, the exercise. What we learned that was interesting is. And it's another thing that's changed my own behaviors as we conducted the research is that if people exercise even for 20 minutes, 30 is better, but if you do at least 20 minutes of vigorous exercise in the morning, you get a boost in your mood throughout the day that's statistically significant and strong at 3 hours out, 6 hours out, and 12 hours out. So I've been a lot more conscious since we started to study this about working out early each morning, not because I know it'll help me from getting heart disease or diabetes 20, 30 years down the road, but because I'll have more energy if I'm giving a talk or having a meeting at work or whatever I'm working on throughout the day. I'll just have a lot more physical energy, and I'll be in a better mood because I worked out in the morning. Now, of course, it's better to work out in the evening versus not working out at all, but you do sleep through that mood boost, theoretically, if you exercise real late in the day.
And so you just said something that you also mentioned in the book, and I think is really maybe the most important sort of lesson or takeaway from the entire book. And that is, for so much of what we do to create a better life, to be healthier, to be more financially secure, what it requires is really sacrificing something in the short term. So if we want to have a great retirement, you know, we can't buy that thing today. We have to take that money and set it aside, and maybe 30, 40 years we'll benefit from it. Or the cheeseburger and fries seems like it would be great now, but it's going to have an effect, you know, down the road. And so what you talk about in the book is really the way to start making some of these changes is to not so much focus on the long-term consequences, because frankly, that's not a huge motivator for most of us. But what
right.
you're saying is you have to create short-term incentives. So if I do this, if I save this, it's going to benefit me right now. Or if I don't eat this, or if I do eat this, it has to benefit me right now. Otherwise, I'm just not going to do it. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to that realization, and maybe more importantly, how people can create these short-term incentives for themselves?
Yeah, you know, it's really true that it's those everyday little moments that matter. So if you think about, at a base level, you have to get each day off to a good start. So the third element I mentioned there was sleep, and we've learned a lot about, you know, when people get at least 7 to 8 hours sleep, for most people that's what they need, that not only helps you to remember what you learned the day before, but to absorb a lot more and be sharper the next day. So if you want to have a good day, to have positive interactions with loved ones, to get a lot done at work, just to have fun throughout the day, you really do need to set yourself up right in terms of getting a sound night's sleep, ideally exercising in the morning. And you know, I've always been so motivated work-wise to get things done that I'd start working first thing in the morning, not exercise, but I've actually had to force myself into a default where even if I'm traveling, the first thing I do in the morning is get up extra early to get that exercise, because I know I'll get more out of each subsequent hour throughout that single day. And the same thing goes for kind of sleep and diet, where those things accumulate, where if I were to have a big bloating breakfast, might knock the whole day off course, right? And then I'm not very productive into the evening. So it's beginning to think about how you structure those little decisions throughout the day to maximize what's in your own short-term interest, because like you said, that's a better motivator. And then eventually that all adds up and helps you out in the long run, which, as we discussed, isn't as good at keeping you motivated on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, that is absolutely huge, because changing behavior is incredibly difficult. And if our benefit, if the payoff isn't going to be until 20 or 30 years, it's just not going to happen. That's why so many people still smoke and still drink excessively, because you don't get that immediate consequence. And so you got to figure out short-term benefits, even if they're small, which will help you then start making some changes. Okay, so the last final element, community. I'm telling you, if there was any of them that is probably the most confusing, not that this one is confusing, but the others are pretty self-explanatory. But community, what do you mean by community, and how is that going to help me?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I would have thought before we got all this research back in from the field that community might be similar to that social element and kind of the connections and people around you. But there was a distinct factor that emerged that was real important to people, and that was more about where they live. It starts at a basic level of, you know, do you feel safe walking within a mile of your home at night? So is your community safe? Do you take pride in the place where you live? Is it getting better? Do you have access to clean air and water, which matters a heck of a lot in third world countries we were studying? I mean, there's some basic elements in there. But then at the very highest level, in developed countries in particular, what we see is that community well-being, in terms of whether you're involved in the community or giving back to nonprofits, charities, making the surroundings around you better, that's probably what differentiates a good life from one that's really thriving or at a great level. And one of the best questions we ask in that domain of people on our well-being finder is, have you been recognized in the last 6 months for your contributions to the community? So not just something simple like, have you volunteered, which is an easier bar, but it's a real high bar of not only are you giving back, but are you doing so much that an external group's recognizing you for it. And when people can strongly agree with that, you know you're at a real good place in terms of your overall well-being. And, you know, it's also, it was a good learning for me in terms of it's an important place to start, because if you really want to boost your own well-being, the well-being of the people you care about most, the best place to start is kind of just by taking initiative and trying to boost the well-being of other people in the community and the networks around you, instead of sitting back and waiting for well-being to happen to you, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Again, this is the one, at least for me personally, I'm just like, okay, you know, I volunteer. I founded a nonprofit, but as far as in my specific community, am I doing much? Probably not.
That's probably not about your specific community. If there are national groups or any organizations that you're giving back to, that's really what we're measuring there and what matters most. So it's about, is there something, I mean, if you can say to yourself that there's something that you're proud of that you're giving back to a broader group or organization, that might be the best definition of what it means at a real high level.
Oh, okay. So it doesn't have to be in your local town or
no.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe that's a little bit tough to get in terms of meaning more, but it's not about local community per se, but a lot of people derive that from getting involved with national organizations. And one thing I learned when we interviewed people with high community well-being is that the big challenge is just to get started. Most people aren't doing anything with groups like that now, and if they just kind of put their foot in the water and volunteer an hour someplace, that usually starts a pretty good chain reaction. So it's if you're not currently involved in anything from a community, nonprofit, charity standpoint, just to do a little bit in a given year is a quick way to get started.
And more than just giving money, but it's actually spending some time.
Right.
Yeah. And so there was one, I guess maybe it could fit in social, maybe spirituality, you know, religiousness. That's sort of missing here.
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because in the interviews, we do ask a lot of questions about spirituality and whether you regularly attend worship services and how often you pray. And so we investigate that in great depth. And in some cultures and nations, that was very important. And in others, and it even varied a great deal by state in the United States. And in other states and countries, it was not as important to overall well-being. And for the people who did have very high levels of spirituality and attended worship services every week and so on, it was such a big influencing factor in their lives that it's almost larger than those five areas, and it overrides it. And it's what drives you every day. It was interesting. I was talking to a well-known church leader who has congregations all over the country here in the States, and he was talking about how, you know, of course your spirituality can't just be one domain of life, because if you really have that deep belief like a lot of us do, that influences everything you're doing with your job and your family and your community and so forth. But there were also other people we studied, and I mean thousands if not millions of people in parts of Europe and other parts of the world where they didn't claim to be very spiritual, and those nations on average still had relatively high levels of well-being. So that's more of a motivator. Like, I wouldn't put family in a bucket. Family's a big part of what drives you in all those areas, but it's not kind of a distinct factor that you could apply to anyone universally.
That's interesting. Yeah, it seems like spiritual and family are more, just more individual than you could really come up with on a global scale like this.
Yeah, it's more about why you do what you do instead of the outcome, I would suggest.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this has been really, really fascinating for me. And I'm wondering if someone who's listened to this or who's going to be reading this, if they forget everything, what would be that sort of one thing that you would want to leave them with to get from this program?
I would say that just narrow down to one thing, it would be to make sure that if someone from Gallup calls you on a poll in the next 10 years and they ask you if you like what you do each day, you can say yes.
That's a great takeaway. I thought you were going to say, make sure you participate in the survey.
That's
the second takeaway.
I don't even answer my landline sometimes, so it's hard for me to say that with credit.
I'm still waiting for Gallup to call me. They never have. I would love to participate in one of your surveys. So thank you so much for your time here, and really thank you for helping our members create a richer life or increasing their well-being. And so if you want to find out more from Tom, and you should, he has written some fabulous books, including well-being, but definitely check out StrengthFinder 2.0 and just the whole body of work that he's created over the years. It's really fantastic. You can go to wbfinder.com. So WB as in well-being, finder.com. Really great assessment there. Check it out. And if you're ready to put into action what you've just heard, go to richerlife.com. You can get the action script from this program, creating a mind map. There's going to be a video and an ebook from this interview, as well as some voicemail coaching from Tom. So you can really get inspired to create this richer life. And so until next time, I'm Robert Pagliarini. Thank you so much.